1-2 pitch with two outs in the ninth. A swing and the ball is hit on one hop, barehanded by Gonzalez. The second baseman throws out Pajes, and this ball game has come to an end. The Pirates picked up two in the sixth and turned back the Cardinals 2-1.
Yo, Paulie!
Paulie's a great name.
Yo, Paulie!
What'd you do for Paulie? Anything?
Me, Paulie! I was responsible!
Paulie, we're here because of you!
Well, it wasn't great yesterday. The Cardinals struggled to generate any offense, as has been the tune. But they lose to the Pirates 2-1 last night. They do play today at 1:15. First pitch, 1:15. Pre-game show, 12:20. And joining us now is the host of KMOX's Sports Open Line, Redbird Rush Hour, and Cardinals pre- and post-game, and that would be Matt Pauly. Hey, Matt, how are you?
Hey. I'm all right. How are you?
Well, last night wasn't great, but as Brad Young pointed out, he went to the game. It was beautiful weather and there are no lines.
That is true. So, yeah, I mean, the weather's been it finally broke and the last two nights have just been absolutely beautiful. So, yeah, not bad for August.
With the struggle that the Cardinals have had at the plate recently, Ali Marmol was asked about the Cardinals and struggling against the Pirates pitching. And his answer was, well, 100 as in 100 miles an hour. What do you make of where the Cardinals are right now at the plate?
Yeah, I think that's something that we talked about a lot last season, and we haven't talked about it quite as much this year, but this group struggles with velocity. Now, that's not something that's unique to the Cardinals. The number one thing that pitchers are looking for to find success is velocity. And that doesn't mean that other things don't matter. Pitch placement and movement and all that sort of stuff certainly matters. But the number one way to be successful as a pitcher is velocity. So when you're seeing a guy like Bubba Chandler go out and his fastball was almost 101, it was sitting 99, that's something that the Cardinals cannot handle especially well. They're not alone in that, but it's a we've talked about a lot. It is a team that from a talent standpoint does not stand up with some of the other teams in baseball. So nights like last night when you're facing off against a dude who's throwing 100 over and over and over again, it shows up that much more.
Obviously, you've got to have the arms to be able to throw 100, but the Cardinals, as Derek Gould of the Post-Dispatch pointed out in his piece today, that they've seen the second most fastballs of any club this month. So, like I said, the team in their rotation, you got to have the arms that throw 100, but is that because the scouting report on the Cardinals is now just blow it by them?
Yes, without a doubt. If a team struggles with velocity, then show them velocity. And that's what's going on. And that's what teams should do, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's a very basic thing. If the Cardinals hitters can't handle velocity, anytime you've got the opportunity to go throw something at a high level, you should do it. And that's, the Cardinals just did not have an answer for Bubba Chandler last night. That's the story of the game. He goes out there, four innings, only gives up the one hit. Now, they don't do much about the other guys and the other guys that they see as well. But that game was won and lost, I think, during the Bubba Chandler time.
Hey, Matt, Brad Young here. And I refer to Matt as my personal sports Sherpa. That's why I refer to Matt.
We got to add that to his long
sports
title.
Sherpa. It's a good title. So, Matt, I was at the game last night. And one of the things that I think is very instructive about takeaways from the game is how an error can really impact the entire game. Because my seats are right next to first base, and I'm watching that play where the Pirates hit a smash up the first base line. Contreras gets the ball. He's too far away from first base, so he lobs it over to Sonny Gray, who was running to first base to cover it. And Sonny Gray just had a brain meltdown and didn't even bother to try to catch the ball. That's an error. It advanced the runner. Those two runners ended up scoring, and that was the run that beat us. That was the amount that the Pirates defeated the Cardinals last night, was because of that error. So does that drive home the point that errors in a baseball game have consequences, and didn't we see that last night?
Yes. That is the single most important play of the game. It was a weird and funky play because Contreras looked to second first, But the runner was in his throwing lane, so he did not have a way to get the ball to second. So that's why he looked to first. Gray was expecting the ball to go to second, not right to him. So he was looking to second and then kind of put his head down, and he was not looking at Contreras when the ball came his way. So Contreras is culpable. Gray is culpable. Contreras ends up getting the air there. So, Brad, you're right. Yes, errors do have consequences. Now, I would argue, though, if I want to talk out of both sides of my mouth, which I'm able to do so, the Cardinals scored one run last night.
True.
So, yeah, they commit an error that leads to two runs, but you're not going to win many games in the first place that you only score one run. So a lot of times this big, huge spotlight gets placed upon defensive plays. And while it matters, we saw that it mattered last night. It shouldn't matter as much as the guys going to the plate in scoring runs. If the Cardinals have a respectable run scoring night last night, that play is just a footnote.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of been the story this season. The Cardinals are losing a lot of games now, but even at the beginning, when it kind of felt like they were playing about above everybody's expectations, it still felt like the wins were difficult to come by. Every inning felt like a challenge. And when you are struggling and you're splitting hairs, baseball is a game of details. So errors on a team like this matter a lot, in the same way walking the leadoff batter will often come back to bite you in the end.
Yeah. I'll say this, though, because sometimes the Cardinals lean too much into defense. And they'll put, let's take the center field situation, for example. And it's a really, it's a flawed point right now because Lars Nootbaar is not hitting. But let's go to this imaginary situation where Lars Nootbaar is really hitting and you're not getting any offense out of Victor Scott II or Nathan Church, whoever else you have in center field. So Cardinals lean into defense in a really big way, and you end up with Scott in center and Nootbaar in left and whoever in right field. And Scott goes out there and plays super perfect, flawless defense. But you have a spot in the lineup that you're just not getting a whole lot of production out of, and it's weighing you down. The other scenario is you put Nootbaar in center field and defense takes a step back. But you're getting four at-bats, four more plate appearances by better hitters per game. And my contention would be, as much as defense can matter, the difference between like a Lars Nootbaar and a Victor Scott is maybe one or two plays a week. So, yeah, it's great. Defense matters. Defense matters. Defense matters. I'm not running away from that, but it doesn't matter as much as offense. So sometimes I feel like the Cardinals lean into defense too much when you're putting somebody in a certain spot, and literally there's going to be one or two plays over a week that the better defender is going to make as opposed to the lesser defender. And that impacts four plate appearances per game. So sometimes it's frustrating when the Cardinals are not scoring runs that they still lean into defense. Now, if you're a big time run scoring team where every spot in the order doesn't matter quite as much, then lean into defense. That's great. That's a way that you can make yourself better. But I don't know. That can be frustrating sometimes. I just want them to score more runs.
Well, the Cardinals play today. First pitch, 1:15. Pregame show, 12:20. Who's got the pregame today, Matt?
That would be Tom Ackerman.
Tom Ackerman with the pregame show. While we still have you on the line, the Mizzou Tigers kick off their football season tonight against Central Arkansas. And I guess the big question surrounding Mizzou right now is, who is the starting quarterback? I believe they're doing a half-and-half situation tonight.
Yeah, so it's Horn and Pribula. And it's going to be Pribula when all is said and done. This is, I think he's going to be really good. I'm excited about this guy for Mizzou. Early on in the season, in situations like this, especially no disrespect to Missouri's opponent tonight, but I don't think they have to worry too terribly much. They should win. If they don't win the game with either one of those quarterbacks playing, then something's not going right. So again, that's not a shot at the good folks over at Central Arkansas, but that's just the way it is. So I think Oklahoma State's in the same situation where they named a starter, but the other guy's going to play. It's a pretty normal thing when you've got an open quarterback competition and nobody completely obviously differentiates themselves during camp leading up to go ahead and give two guys an opportunity early on in the season.
And Matt, isn't the elephant in the room here also the fact that Sam Horn has apparently signed a contract with the Dodgers? I mean, if you've got one of your potential starting quarterbacks is looking at going with the Dodgers in a professional league situation, can he even really be evaluated as a starter? If you're Mizzou, are you going to be wondering, look, is he going to bail on me to go play with Ohtani, or is he going to be our starting quarterback? Is that even an issue here?
I don't think it's an issue. I think the Dodgers were very understanding that he was going to finish his college football career before joining them. They really wanted him. They gave him money that was well above slot for where he was drafted. He was a 17th round selection. It's kind of an interesting story because he only threw 15 innings of baseball at the collegiate level. But there's a lot of excitement about his arm. He's a project at the same time. He's a high ceiling project for the Dodgers. So he's not somebody who's going to be impacting the big league roster anytime soon. The Dodgers are in a spot right now where they can let guys develop. There's no urgency there. So I think the only thing you would be worried about if you're the Dodgers, I guess, is that there's some type of injury. But even that is not the end of the world because he would get the opportunity to rehab it. So I don't think that everybody seems to be on the same page on this.
Matt, I don't even know that this is a question as it is just stating a fact. But the whole NIL, right, and college sports, I think NIL is now filtering down to Little League World Series. It's insane. But both Horn and Pribula are making seven figures this year, right, in NIL money?
I don't know Horn's numbers when it comes to that. I mean, he got a bunch of money for signing with the Dodgers. He got just under $500,000 for that. I'm not super familiar with his NIL. Pribula, yeah, I mean he came in and got good money. You're probably right.
I
don't know that top of my head.
Yeah, and like I said, it's not even a question. It's just kind of wild to think that a backup college quarterback, let's say Horn is the backup to Pribula, is making seven figures. It's professional sports now.
Yeah, that's what it is. And they've still got to get this. I'm not against players making money. And, you know, with the recent house settlement, a lot of this is going to start coming through the athletic department as opposed to these third parties. It's still the wild, wild west. It's still changing on a week by week basis. We still see things being challenged in court all the time. We're in a very weird period for college athletics, and I'm not going to complain about it. All I'm going to say is I just want it to get to wherever it's going to be, whatever it's going to look like, and then it can just stay there so we kind of all understand the rules.
I think that's going to be a while. I feel like the college world is never simple, but we'll figure it out.
No, it is not.
He's Matt Pauly, host of KMOX's Sports Open Line and the Redbird Rush Hour and a Cardinals pre- and post-game, although today Tom Ackerman will have the pregame show at 12:20, first pitch 1:15 right here on KMOX Cardinals and Pittsburgh Pirates. Matt, thank you so much.
You bet. Thanks, guys.
Yo, Paulie, your sister's with me. I'll call you back later. See ya.
And also, it is a pretty interesting story, Missouri's Sam Horn. If you Google Washington Post Mizzou quarterback, it'll come up. They did a nice piece on him, which was kind of fun.
Good.
That's Brad Young. I'm Amy Markscores. We've got our question of the week. We'll revisit it with Brad next on the Chris and Amy.
T-R-Y.
It's the Chris and Amy Show on 104.1 FM KMOX, sponsored by the St. Louis Aquarium. Explore the St. Louis Aquarium at Union Station.
Brad Young, Amy Markscores with you. And if you follow us at Chris Amy KMOX on Twitter, you can participate in our weekly question of the week. And we debut the question, Brad, every Tuesday. And this week, our question is Bruce Springsteen overrated? We would love to hear from all of you at Christy McKMOX, but I'd also love to hear Brad's thoughts on this.
Yeah, I'm going to make a lot of people mad, but okay. When does that ever stop me?
I don't care.
Bruce Springsteen is so overrated. I mean, it's not even close. And I can give you three great reasons, because I like to think all of my opinions are based in logic and reason, all right? And I have three great reasons.
And I want to hear those, because I appreciate this about you, because I said he was overrated.
Yeah.
And my opinion is completely arbitrary and unfounded. So okay. I'm really glad that you have, like, I pretty much figured I was wrong. So I would love to hear this.
Right. Well, first of all, I think his musical style lacks innovation, because he's been doing the same thing for 50 years. Okay. And he's one of those people like Paris Hilton, who let me tell you what. Paris Hilton, and my kids would say to me, Dad, why is Paris Hilton a celebrity? I would say, I have no earthly idea. She's a celebrity because she's a celebrity. Yeah. She hasn't done anything.
Famous
she doesn't
for
have
being
any,
famous.
She doesn't, she's famous for being famous, right? Bruce Springsteen is famous for being famous. His musical style has no innovation, and he hasn't done one thing different in the last 50 years, okay?
Let me give out the number, 314-436-7900.
See, I got an opinion on everything, all right? And you can text in, and listen, I'll always defend my opinions. Happy to do it. But also, his lyrics lack any sophistication, okay? A big hit. I'm on fire. Wow, Bruce, you stayed up all night thinking that one up, didn't you, pal? I'm on fire. Oh, I'm overwhelmed by the complexity and the intellectual stimulation from that lyric. I'm on fire. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. And the third reason, see, I got reasons
you
for
do,
everything.
You do.
Third reason is his whole persona of being this blue-collar hero from New Jersey. The whole thing's contrived. He's a multi-Uber millionaire who hangs out with big time celebrities, but he comes across as being this blue collar guy who hangs out with firefighters. Listen, the only time he hangs out with firefighters is during photo ops. Okay. He's not hanging out with firefighters. He's hanging out with the Obamas over on Martha's Vineyard is what he's doing. And so to say, oh, I'm a man of the people. I'm a man of the people. Oh, really? How much money did you pay in taxes last year, buddy? No amount of people are paying what you're paying in taxes, dude. So his whole persona is contrived. Wow. So three great reasons.
Wow. I have to be honest, not expecting that. I had nothing but for my arbitrary opinion. Let's start with number three. Was he a man of the people before he got famous? Because you can't fault someone for success.
Correct. I think he truly was. Okay. He was from the streets of New Jersey. Okay, that's a great story. All right, join be in the cast of Jersey Boys then. All right, but I saw at the Muni just last week. But that persona, he's carried over that persona when it stopped being real 45 years ago. Right, it stopped being real, and yet he's tried to carry on this mythos of being a guy streets of New Jersey, when I don't know today if he could find New Jersey on a map, because he's hanging out with the millionaire crowd.
New Jersey is small, so it is harder to find on a map.
It is. Well, you can always smell it. You know when you're close.
You know
to
when
New
you're
Jersey,
close.
You smell the trash.
Okay. Matt, you're a music guy.
Yeah.
You're a huge music guy. Do you think Bruce Springsteen is overrated?
I want to say a little bit. I mean, I look like Bruce Springsteen's biggest fan compared to Brad Young, though. I like his songs. I like his music. I don't put him as like one of the greatest, or I don't put him on a Mount Rushmore of anything. I've always preferred like John Cougar Mellencamp, who I think is very similar and has that kind of blue collar appeal. My dad always said that John Mellencamp was like a poor man's Bruce Springsteen, which I disagree with, because I like John Mellencamp a little bit better. But like, you know, Bruce Springsteen's whole shtick is that he's got the 3-hour concert and he's not going to stop to take any breaks. And he just when I think of Bruce Springsteen music, I don't think I want to hear this for 3 hours.
Yeah.
Or if I think of a 3-hour concert, what band do I want to see? It's not Bruce Springsteen music. No. I don't know. That's just me. But I know he's still one of the greats. I don't have the disdain that Brad Young does.
And lest people think, oh, that's because Matt Pajeski's young. That's not true at all, because you brought down the average age by 40 years when you went to, was it the keyboard player?
With John Hancock
with
and
John
the guys.
Hancock, yeah.
So we saw Rick Wakeman from Yes. We've seen John Anderson from Yes. We go to the old rock and roll concerts. I love that stuff.
Yeah. So he's not just a kid. Now, the text line is blowing up. The first one took issue, said, "You're forfeiting your credibility comparing Bruce Springsteen to Paris Hilton. What a joke." But then, which, don't worry, we forfeited our credibility way before that.
I know. But wait, let me explain that, though. The only way I was comparing the two is that it's famous for being famous. Yeah. And I think that's what Bruce Springsteen is now. Early albums, amazing, very innovative, nothing in 50 years. And now I think he's just famous for being famous.
I agree with Matt. Now I look like a fan compared to Brad. But the text, we'll get to these texts in a bit. We've got Andrew Egger, White House correspondent for The Bulwark, coming up next. We'll get to your text in a bit because Brad does have some support. It's the Chris and Amy Show on KMOX. It is the Chris and Amy Show. Brad Young sitting in for Chris Ranji. And normally at this time, we chat with Major Garrett, CBS Chief Washington correspondent, but he is out on assignment. So we've got the ever faithful and true, the excellent Andrew Egger, White House correspondent for The Bulwark. Andrew, thank you for coming in clutch today.
Hey guys, thanks for having me. Major does some real work every now and then, but I'm always happy to come on and chat. I'm usually free around this time.
Well, and we're not just using you as a fill-in. We like having you on anyway, so just so you know.
Well,
you're also coming on, I have to say, at a very, it's a tumultuous time because we just had a very heated discussion about Bruce Springsteen being overrated or not. So you are coming in and the listeners are heated at the moment. So fair warning.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. We'll smooth things over. We'll talk everybody down.
Let's start with some breaking news, at least this morning, that the former Federal Reserve Governor, Lisa Cook, who was fired by President Donald Trump, has filed a lawsuit against the president. What do we know about this?
Yeah, so this is the latest kind of clash between Donald Trump and the Federal Reserve, which he has chafed at for a long time over his inability to kind of like more directly set monetary policy. This is sort of a subset of that, but it's also its own separate thing because the president has said that he is firing her essentially due to some alleged misconduct about a mortgage application, which is a thing he's reached for a couple of his political opponents. He's made a similar case about, for instance, Senator Adam Schiff. But essentially what the governor is saying, what Mrs. Cook is saying is that that this is not an adequate for cause firing. And she's pushing back in particular on the question of whether the president has sort of overstepped his authority in directing essentially like mortgage fraud authorities in the federal government, the regulators at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, to look unduly into people who are already his political opponents. She's basically saying, you know, this is not stuff that the president is stumbling across. This is kind of a fishing expedition to find things that he can then use to hang charges on people who are kind of in his way politically. And again, this is not, when I say hang charges, she has not been charged with a crime or anything, but there's been this misconduct alleged, essentially. So that's where we are right now in terms of what the president's alleging and what she's pushing back within this lawsuit.
Yeah, Andrew, Brad Young here. And under the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, as you've already kind of mentioned about having a for-cause firing, typically, if you look at case law and how that has been interpreted over the years, for-cause means that at trial, in order to defend against this, Trump would have to prove that the Fed governor actually did commit mortgage fraud, and that was the basis for a termination. But we haven't really seen any actual evidence of this, have we? I mean, the only thing that I've seen in being reported is this allegation of mortgage fraud, but we haven't seen any evidence of it, have we?
Yeah, and I am certainly not like a mortgage fraud expert. My understanding of this is that it's a pretty thin rod. Essentially, what they're alleging is that you know, this is a person who, like many top officials in D.C., owns a home where they're from and owns a home in the D.C. area where they're working right now, and that on their mortgage applications to get loans for both of those homes, they essentially treated both of them as though they were primary residences, which is, you know, in theory where you live, supposed to be where you live 50% of the time plus one day or whatever. From what I have been told, this is not a particularly uncommon kind of thing that people do to fudge, you know, this, th- these, you know, that they're like, oh, you know, I'm splitting my time between these two places and I'm going to just fill them both out as primary residences. I have also been told, again, I'm not an expert on this, you're not really supposed to do that, right? It's like you know, it's just sort of like this thing that people have done, which is maybe cutting a corner on the law. Whether it implicates her job performance at the Fed or implicates, you know, Senator Adam Schiff's job performance as a senator is another question, right? As well as, is this a thing that would actually be, like, pursued as criminal under other circumstances? And I think the answer there is often not.
Yeah, and if you look at the case law and how this has been litigated over the years, typically it requires the person to commit something related to their job as being the for cause for termination. I haven't heard of any allegations of any sort of cause that would be subject to termination regarding the Fed governor's actual job duties. It's all focused on this personal mortgage situation, correct?
Yes, absolutely. And that kind of shows just how far off the map we are with a lot of this stuff, because, I mean, the original reason that the president was trying to fire a lot of people, not in this case, but you know, across the federal government in a lot of these roles where people can just be fired for cause by law. I mean, the law says there has to be a cause. The president can't just unilaterally terminate them. Originally, the president was essentially trying to say that shouldn't bind me. I'm going to try to just do it anyway. And that got very quickly tied up in the courts, right? Like, so he kind of got brushed back on his original plan of just saying I shouldn't be bound by these sorts of regulations. These are essentially unconstitutional. I'm the executive. I should be able to decide who works for the executive in the executive branch. So now that there has been kind of that play has gotten snarled up, they're moving to sort of like the next thing over, which is, okay, let's find a cause. Let's say there's been some misconduct here. There's been some kind of issue. And as you say, in this case and in many other cases, that has very little to do with the actual job performance. It's a little bit comparable, although even further afield than the allegations they've made about Jerome Powell himself, the chair of the Federal Reserve, where you've kind of seen them in recent weeks start to spin up this allegation that he had mismanaged, you know, the renovation of the Fed headquarters in D.C. and, you know, gone over budget on that. And like that might in theory be a cause to eventually terminate him. So you kind of see them again. Plainly, the actual goal here is to exert more personal control over the rate policies of the Federal Reserve, and they are kind of grabbing any tool to hand to do that.
Yes, because let's say there were an issue, and the fraud issue or whatever it may be with the governor of the Federal Reserve. Well, the Federal Reserve is legally an independent agency, but if there needs to be some oversight, isn't that the oversight supposed to be Congress, not the president?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little of both, right? Because, I mean, a lot of these statutory protections that are in place for these jobs are a matter of law, right? The Congress has put them in place. The president's people would argue that maybe they shouldn't have put those in place. Maybe those are you know, an unconstitutional overreach on Congress's part by you know, limiting the president's ability to fire people in these sort of semi-autonomous parts of the executive branch. And obviously, that gets into much deeper constitutional questions about whether the Constitution should permit, you know, parts of the executive to be beyond the reach of the executive. There are smart lawyers on both sides of that question. There are smart lawyers on the president's side who essentially say it's crazy to have a setup where you know, there are people who in theory work for the president, but the president does not have this sort of personnel authority over him. And then there are other people who say this system's worked pretty well. You know, it's allowed us to have these independent agencies that are free, largely free of kind of like political meddling and influence, and that's a good system, and that's the way Congress set it up. So that's all kind of in the background of this conversation, that sort of legal question over against even just the political one that we're talking about as well.
We're talking to Andrew Egger. He's the White House correspondent for The Bulwark. And Andrew, much has been made about President Trump's so-called takeover of Washington, D.C. There's been a lot of press reporting about how their government officials are upset about it. The city doesn't like it. The city officials don't like it. But let's look at the underlying issue. Do we have any data, or do you have any anecdotal or even personal experience about whether the crime situation has gotten better since the deployment of federal troops and the FBI in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, so we actually did see a little bit of data on this. I believe just this morning it was announced that in the time since this crackdown has been put into place, violent crime in the city is down, according to the data I saw this morning, 58%, you know, across about a week and a half. So that's preliminary, but it's real. It's a real, you know, it's obviously a quite significant dip. And I think the question is, what do you attribute that to, right? I mean, obviously, you know, more cops in the streets are going to result in less obvious out and out crime in the streets, just sort of for obvious reasons. So the question is, what percentage of that dip is just we're doing more policing now, there's a greater show of force, people are more scared to commit crimes, and what percentage of it is permanent versus just like, wow, okay, maybe I was going to commit a crime before, but like now it's like I need to wait and see what's going on here. You know what I mean? Like how depressed it will remain versus whether any of this is sort of like a temporary drop. There's part of it is also that there has just been a temporary drop in like being outside in D.C., right? I mean, like everybody has kind of gone to ground, not just the criminals, right? It's people are a little freaked out about like just sort of the, you know, these federal troops, these people in kind of like unmarked uniforms and masks and things like that. It has created an issue for things like restaurant traffic in the city. So there are all these kind of other things that you know, some city residents are concerned about as well. But when it comes to the question of has it reduced crime, I think at least the preliminary answer to that is definitely yes, it has.
Andrew, the White House has said that it has fired the director of the CDC, Susan Monterez, and she has been removed from her job, also because of some of the policies of RFK Jr. Three senior CDC leaders submitted their resignations yesterday. That's according to emails from the Wall Street Journal. What do you make of the chaos right now at the CDC, or is it chaos?
Yeah, this is going to be a huge sort of personnel legal headache for a lot of the same reasons that the Fed governor, Lisa Cook, who we were just talking about is, I mean, a lot of these same questions are implicated there. Just to go a little bit broader to the question of what's going on at the CDC in terms of policy, I mean, I think what we are seeing is more and more sort of career CDC employees who maybe originally were sort of staying on in the hope that, you know, RFK Jr. coming in atop Health and Human Services as secretary of that agency was not going to be, you know, as disruptive as it has proven to be. I think maybe they knew that he had a long history as like a critic of HHS and CDC and just public health in America in general, a longtime critic of vaccines and you know, America's vaccine agenda, or not agenda, vaccine apparatus. But he had made a lot of noises during his confirmation hearings, like he was going to not necessarily govern that way, right? He wasn't going to meddle with various vaccine advisory committees. He wasn't going to meddle with the vaccine schedule that children receive at their, you know, regular pediatric appointments, all that kind of stuff. And since he has come in, he has thrown all that out, right? I mean, he's been very, very disruptive in terms of all kinds of public health policy, especially around vaccines. This particular story is so strange because this is a person who just got in there, right? I mean, the current director of the CDC has only been in that job for about a month, and came in under the RFK apparatus. So I don't know if there's like, you know, I don't think any of us know whether there are, you know, personnel things under the surface or, you know, like particular disagreements. But the bottom line for, you know, this sort of rash of resignations that we are seeing is, wow, this guy is actually kind of like setting out to chop down a lot of the U.S. sort of vaccine set up with like an axe, like, or a blunter instrument than that, and we're not going to be a party to that.
Well, one more question on that CDC issue, Andrew, and that's this. Didn't the CDC come out with some changes about COVID-19 vaccinations just this week? And couldn't that impact how people have access to COVID-19 vaccines going forward?
Yeah, so this has been, this story has been kind of a death of a thousand cuts. RFK Jr. has taken a number of different swings at the COVID vaccines. He has removed the recommendation that many types of, first the recommendation that all healthy adults get them, that's been gone. He took them off the childhood vaccine schedule, so that's you know, gone. This week it's been reported that he has contemplated, you know, yanking the FDA authorization for them altogether. And then The other big story that we've been looking at with regard to RFK and vaccines this week has not just been about the COVID vaccines, but it's been about him potentially changing the U.S. Regulation system around liability for vaccine injury, which is he has long had an axe to grind over the fact that individual people who have side effects after receiving a vaccine aren't able to sue vaccine manufacturers over that. That dates back to a law that was passed in the 80s to basically just keep vaccine companies from going out of business over, punitive lawsuits over very, very rare vaccine injuries. So he would like to, reopen all of that up. And that would have effects massively beyond just the COVID vaccine, because the thing about vaccines is they're not particularly profitable for pharma companies, right? They're pretty low margin items. You get them once or twice when you're a kid, as compared to something like a pill you take all your life, right? Those are the things that actually make these companies money. So the fact that these companies, produce vaccines is in part just because we really need them, right? I mean, and policymakers have gone out of their way to ensure that it's not in an environment where these become higher risk than higher reward for these companies over the years. And so that is a thing that a lot of public health people are very concerned about. If it became far easier to, again, sue these companies for these very rare sorts of side effects that are rare, but they do happen, then it could be, you could get into a case where even the vaccines that remain on the schedule are no longer available because companies won't think the juice is worth the squeeze to make them.
Andrew Egger, White House correspondent for The Bulwark, helping to bring some serenity to the conversation by talking about Washington, D.C. over Bruce Springsteen. We really appreciate you. Thanks so much. And for our listeners, Andrew Egger, fellow 314.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. I'm pro-Bruce.
He's pro-Bruce and a fellow St. Louisan. We appreciate you, Andrew. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
Andrew Egger, White House correspondent for The Bulwark. He's Brad Young. I'm Amy Markscores. This is The Christening.
You people have obviously not seen Bruce Springsteen live, or you would quit uttering this guttural nonsense.
Well, first of all, it's never flattering when someone addresses you as you people. Like, you always know it's going to go downhill.
Yeah, you never say, you people, you're wonderful,
you're
and
wonderful
I love everything
and I
you
love,
say.
Yeah.
No, it never does that.
No, I will say to that caller's point, I bet he's right. I mean, I bet if I saw Bruce Springsteen live, I would love him. I do think you two would be an amazing concert. I have zero U2 songs on Spotify, back in the day on iTunes. I never listened to U2. They're not my vibe, but I can objectively understand how they're one of the best rock bands. So I bet the caller is right. I would have a change of heart.
I would concede that.
I will say I sound like I love Bruce Springsteen compared to you. It was a scathing rebuke. And some of the texts have... The text line has been blowing up, but we did have several texts come in on your side.
Yes.
On your side, Brad Young, that Bruce Springsteen is overrated. And I believe right now the poll, which is still up at Chris Amy KMOX, the poll also shows that the current majority believe Bruce Springsteen is overrated.
Thank you.
Not doesn't mean he's terrible. Doesn't mean is a stinker.
No, not at all. I was just laying out the case for him being overrated. And I think I did it well.
Yeah. No, I think you did it more than well. And like I said, I felt bad and felt the need to defend him. hopefully Brad Young does not feel the same way about the Doobie Brothers.
No, because not at all.
We will be giving away tickets to the Doobie Brothers in the next hour. Not now. Do not call now. But at some point in the next hour, you'll be prompted to call in to win tickets to see the Doobie Brothers at the Hollywood Casino Amphitheater on September 4th. Today and tomorrow are your last days to win tickets. So good luck to everyone, but not now. That would be in the next hour.
Another 314 guy, Michael McDonald.
There you go. Wow, that's a great point. Okay, coming up at 11, this is really, really good. We're talking to Natasha Zuvas. She is a News Nation Prime anchor, and she has a special, a documentary called What Were They Doing in St. Louis? And it looks at government testing in Pruitt-Igoe, like testing for warfare tactics and spraying chemicals in Pruitt-Igoe. She interviews people who grew up there. It's astounding. You don't want to miss it. Natasha joins us next. It's the Chris and Amy Show on KMOX. Amy Show on KMOX.